Blog Talk Radio.
Hi out there, everybody. It's Movie Geeks United. I hope everyone out there has had a good weekend or is having a good week, depending upon when you're listening to the show. This is an exciting 2 weeks because our co-host Dean is reporting live from the New York Film Festival. We're going to bring him up in just a second, and you'll be able to hear all that wonderful New York street ambiance. How many sirens are we going to hear tonight, Jerry? What do you think?
Oh, I think we're going to hear 20.
Okay, 20.
Yeah,
I'll go for 19.
Okay,
let's go ahead and bring in Dean. Dean, buddy, how are you?
Hey, pretty good. So, I'm sitting out here in Queens, in Astoria, right outside of the Museum of the Moving Image, and actually, right now, I can look around the corner here and see the gate to Kaufman Astoria Studios, where so many great movies and TV shows have been filmed. A lot of our favorites from the 70s, Sidney Lumet's, The Verdict and The Wiz. And right now, currently, they're filming Orange is the New Black and White Collar here. And just incredible history here. So I spent the day at the Museum of the Moving Image. And let me just tell you, if you're a film fan and you're in New York, you would be foolish not to come to the Museum of the Moving Image, because for $12 you can watch all of the movies that they're playing. Today I watched an hour's worth of Chuck Jones animated shorts, and then about an hour's worth of Bill Plimpton shorts, which he has an exhibit of his work here that's running until the middle of November. So our friend Bill Plimpton, whom we've had on the show, has a really nice exhibit here where you get to see his original art and his works that are constantly being projected here. And then when you go and take a look at the exhibits, it's just ridiculous what they have here. Stuff from 2001 and the makeup that John Hurt wore in The Elephant Man. And there's a life cast, a head cast of Al Pacino for Godfather, made for Godfather 2. And many.
I'm booking my flight now.
Unbelievable, set interactive things, to show you how movies are made, a looping studio and an editing booth and a place where you can make your own animation it's just nuts what's here. And the value to it is just immense. So Nick, I'm not only going to just record the show from here this week, I'm also coming back next week because they're showing us the Jerk next week on 35mm. So I said, I got to see that. So for $12, you can't beat it. Right now they're also having an ongoing two-month-long retrospective of the Taiwanese director Ho Chau Shin. And also later on in October, they're doing 35mm showings of all the classic horror films. So Chainsaw and Nosferatu, Exorcist, and so on and so forth. So if you want to see those on the big screen, you just can't beat it. You know, it's amazing here.
You know what we should do one time? I just happened to think of this. What we should do one time, we tried this years ago on Jason's show when I was a guest on it, and it didn't work. But we need to find a way to do a screening of a movie that the three of us love, to watch it at the exact same time, stream it at the exact same moment, so we can provide commentary on it between the three of us. That would be fun.
Yes. I thought about that myself for the show, and by the way, I don't think you're going to hear many sirens because this is a little bit of a younger neighborhood than the neighborhood I was living in, you know, when I first started the show. That neighborhood was filled with old people, so you heard a lot of sirens all the time because there were people having heart attacks left and right in that neighborhood. But this neighborhood's a little bit healthier, so you're probably just going to hear maybe some motorcycles and a lot of buses and stuff, but probably not a lot of sirens. So
I always enjoyed hearing from you reporting from Dante's Inferno. So it's too bad that. Going to be a little bit more lax tonight.
But I at least did come out to the street instead of doing it from inside the museum. So, and by the way, this museum if you've been to the Museum of the Moving Image, like if you went in the 90s or in the early 2000s or whatever, that was at an old location, you know, still in the same neighborhood, but it was at an old location, and that was a much darker, smaller exhibition space. Their new exhibition space is ridiculously beautiful. I mean, unbelievable how gorgeous it is in there and how well laid out and entertaining it is. And just, I cannot overemphasize this enough. If you love movies, you happen to be in New York, even make a trip up here to come to this specifically. You're just never going to see a collection like this. I mean, you know, the only thing that I could see ever rivaling it in America would be the museum that the Academy is now building, you know, out in L.A. But this is, it's just nuts what's here.
Here's an idea. I'm coming up with ideas tonight. Why don't we, Jerry, produce a movie between the three of us, like a movie geek movie, have it be like a takeoff of Indiana Jones, where we all kind of go out and try to scavenge for historical movie stuff. Like, here's the missing ending of The Magnificent Ambersons. This belongs in a museum.
Right.
And we bring it to the museum.
It would be like...
I didn't,
it would
it's
be
funny.
Like,
I've been thinking about Magnificent Ambersons so much lately.
I mean, that's a great movie. Deserves thinking about. They have they have some Magnificent Ambersons stuff here in the museum. They have some casts of Orson Welles' nose. Because, you know, Orson Welles hated his nose. So in almost every movie, he's wearing a fake nose, a different kind of fake nose. And that's why sometimes he looks radically different in every movie that you see him in. So they have some of Orson Welles'
fake
noses. Well,
you know, to be honest, I'm sure that he would have preferred not to smell the things he had to later on in life. Anyway,
yes,
okay, we got to get to the screenings that you've seen, Dean, because that's why people came tonight. So,
yes,
among other things,
The first weekend of New York Film Festival, what were the big movies that you've seen thus far?
Okay, so I came in on Wednesday, and I was planning to see the new Cronenberg movie Wednesday afternoon, but I came in just a little too late, so I did miss that. But I am going to watch an online screener later on in the week, and then I'll be able to report on it. And also later on in the week, I'll be watching also a new movie by Alex Ross Perry called Listen Up, Philip, which is with Jason Schwartzman and Elizabeth Moss. It's supposedly based on kind of a Philip Roth kind of author, you know, so I think you'd be interested in that, Jerry. But, okay, so the first movie, I'm just going to do them in order, in the order that I saw them, okay? So the first movie that I sat down to watch on Thursday morning was the restored print, 78 minutes long, of Sergei Parajanov's unbelievable masterpiece, The Color of Pomegranates, which I think is on Criterion. I'm not sure, but at any rate, this is the first time I've ever seen Color of Pomegranates on the big screen, and let me tell you, that it really changes things. Watching it on television, no matter how big your television happens to be, it's just not the same, because it's a very unusual movie in the sense that there's no dialogue in it, there's no actual back-and-forth dialogue at all, it's a movie that kind of it tells the story, by the way, of an Armenian poet named Sayat Nova. I think that's the original title of the movie. And the whole movie consists of almost like religious tableau-like shots of scenes from this poet's life. It's sort of like almost like an inner life that's going on, in the poet's heart, and that's what the movie is trying to get at. Some people might look at the movie as being something that's rather plotless. I even thought that it was plotless before I saw it on the big screen at New York Film Festival, but seeing it at the on the screen, I really got this time what it really was, the real heart of the movie. And I'm telling you, it's just almost an indescribable masterpiece that just has to be seen. So if you do have a chance to see it at the New York Film Festival, which, by the way, you can, they're still selling tickets. A lot of these shows are sold out, but if you're interested in going to the New York Film Festival, just go to filmlink.com and that will lead you to the whole schedule and so forth. And of course, they're selling the tickets at the Lincoln Center.
The color of pomegranates came out in 68, and it was
yes.
It was cut up because of religious content.
When does it take place, though? Does it cover the genocide?
It doesn't really. It might actually maybe elliptically. I think that there's, I'm not really familiar with the history, and I think that if I knew more of the history of Armenia and so forth, in fact, I'd like to go and research it, because I think the more that you know about the history and specifically of this poet's life, I think the richer the movie will become.
Right, of course.
I think it's like in the 16th century or something like that.
Then it's not going to cover that. Okay.
It's quite early, quite a long time ago. But I have never really seen any of Parajanov. I haven't seen any of Parajanov's other movies. And I think I'm saying his name correctly, but I haven't seen his other movies, but, this is the one. I mean, I'm telling you, it's a freaking masterpiece, and it's so, so unusual. There's just, I venture to say there's absolutely nothing like it in the history of movies.
It would be the 18th century.
18th century. Okay. All right. See, I mean, I told you, I don't know much about the history, but it's ridiculously beautiful. So I move on to the next movie. the next movie that I saw was Owen Moverman. Director of The Messenger and Rampart. He's got a new film out. And it's scheduled to drop next year, so it's got distribution, but it won't be out until early in 2015. The movie is called Time Out of Mind, and it stars Richard Gere as a New York homeless man. I mean, basically, the movie begins with him passed out in an apartment that's actually being managed by Steve Buscemi. Steve Buscemi is the first person you see in the movie, by the way. And Deer is passed out, and he's kind of run out of the building, you know, by Buscemi. And basically the entire movie it's kind of plotless. They don't really give any kind of backstory to Deer's character. We don't know why he's homeless, what he'd done in the past. We do know that he had a family. He has a daughter. The daughter is played by Jenna Malone. But we really don't know a whole lot about him. And as the character says in the movie, he says, basically, I'm just a fuck up. I've always been a fuck up, and that's it. And basically the entire movie consists of him basically just the life of a homeless person, trying to find a mattress to sleep on and trying to find the next meal and the next drink and the next person to make any kind of contact with. This is probably Richard Gere's one of his top three performances ever. I mean, I would put it up there with The Hoax that he did, that movie that he did with Lasse Hallström, and, you know, and maybe Chicago, you know. I think that it's really one of his absolute greatest performances. It's really an unusual movie for him, too, because usually Gere is playing somebody who's rather self-assured in his movies, you know. He's playing somebody who has control of things, you know. But this is a movie in which he has no control. And the way Movermann shoots the film, they shot the film with lots of long lenses, you know. So the camera and the crew are often really, really far away. And Movermann shoots through glass and through, there's lots of things obscuring the vision a lot of the times. And it creates this kind of feeling that you're kind of submerged underwater, like you're almost suffocating with this character, you know. In the middle of the movie, there's a great supporting performance that pops up from Ben Vereen, who plays a fellow homeless man who strikes up a friendship with a kind of a tenuous friendship with Richard Gere. And Keira Sedgwick is in it too, and a very, very interesting cast of character actors in it as well. So I really, really dug it a lot. I think that some people might find it a little tough to get through, because it doesn't, you know, Gere's character is somebody who is almost invisible. As Gere said at the press conference afterwards, he said he's not only just invisible, it's like he's in a black hole. He's just trying to connect with almost anybody. And Gere talked about the fact that, you know, in the movie, you see him out on the street panhandling. And he talked about filming some of those scenes because all he had to do was really just, you know, he put on the costume and everything. He's got a little hat, you know, a little woolen cap on, and he's out there, you know, hustling change from people. And that's real. He's really out there. None of the people know that they're being filmed. I mean, there's a pie. They said that there was a pie board saying, "We are filming something here," but no one really cared. And so he's really out there panhandling. And he said, absolutely nobody wanted to make eye contact with me. Nobody knew that it was me. He said, strangely enough, only two people recognized him, and they were both African Americans, and they both said, "Hey, Rich, what are you doing here?" You know, and
you know, that's also a big reason why they kept the cameras at such a great distance, because they wanted to get that kind of verite feel. But here's here's the major complaint about the movie, and you can answer to this. I mean, you already talked about it being kind of plotless. It's kind of a narrative feature disguised as a documentary. The problem with that is a lot of people say there's no dramatic thrust to it.
Well, the reason for that is that I think it's good that they didn't do that. I think that to have any kind of more drama in it, I mean, I think it's dramatic enough, this fight for life, you know, this fight to merely sleep and eat and maybe have a beer or two every once in a while. Well, probably every day for this character, or at least maybe even a bottle of vodka every day. But I think that's quite enough drama for a movie.
Sound like The Saint of Fort Washington with Matt Dillon and Danny Glover, kind of a Tim Hunter film from like the early 90s?
It's much better than that. Much better than that, because that's a movie that has those two characters have a little bit more of a fellowship going on, and that creates kind of a safety zone in that movie. There is no safety zone in this movie. This is a movie that really puts you there, really gives you the feeling of what being a homeless person truly is like, and I think that that's quite enough drama. So I'm glad that they didn't try and goose it up with a whole bunch of goofy
He's got a daughter
and stuff like
that.
That
he hasn't seen in years.
Yeah.
And he goes to find all that kind of stuff.
That's about as much plot as there is in it. Is him trying to reconnect with the daughter here and there, and it also.
That is in the movie?
It's also a movie about... Well, I mean, he is trying to reconnect with the daughter, but it's only here and there. It's not a big deal.
See, I just made that up. I just made that up thinking that was the stereotypical thing that you do in a movie like that.
Dude, that Jamie, that's classic. Oh, my God, dude, that's hilarious.
I did mention that he has a daughter in the movie played by Jenna Malone.
I gotta say something though. I mean, I think Richard Gere's best performance is Internal Affairs, where he's playing against type as a psycho cop.
Thank you for reminding me of that. That is amazing. That's amazing.
And I also like The Hoax. I think The Hoax is a really good movie.
Richard Gere is a really...
The Hunting Party, I've never seen that.
Richard, that's the Richard Shepherd movie, but isn't it? But Richard Gere is a guy that is endlessly interesting when he takes chances, and it seems like, this section of his career, actually from Internal Affairs on into, you know, the past decade or so, he's actually taken some. And good for him, because we don't think of him as a great actor, because I don't think he's really given himself permission to be that for a lot of his career.
You didn't think King David was a great movie?
Yeah, but his career started out so...
I'm joking.
So stunningly, I mean, when your first movie is with Terrence Malick, And I'm sure that's the direction...
That was the first movie, by the way,
he ever shot. It's not the first movie to be released, but it was, yeah.
I see. Okay. But, he's always been a very, for me, a little hit and miss, but when he's great, I dig him. And I think he's, I love Primal Fear, too, and I love him in Looking for Mr. Goodbar. I think he's great in that.
Yeah, but, I mean, when you talk about Primal Fear and, like, Pretty Woman, for him, was his big comeback, because in the 80s, I mean, every movie role in the 80s from after Officer and the Gentleman, well, here's another nail in Richard Gere's coffin, was the running joke was throughout the 80s.
Which is too bad, because, I mean, he did set out to work with good people. He just worked with them on the wrong movie. I mean, stuff like Sidney Lumet's Power.
Yeah,
that was
Power.
either the George Hamilton one or the Richard Gere one. There are movies that, you know, there's a George Hamilton movie called The Power, which is awful, and then there's a Richard Gere movie. Starting with Pretty Woman, and so that 1990, he actually comes back in the public spotlight and then stays, you know, from there on out. But
I like that movie also that he did a couple of years ago called Haiti, A Dog's Tale. Is that what it's
that's,
called?
I think
it's
that's
record.
What it's. That's one of his best. I think that's really one of his. And Joan Allen. It's probably the last thing I saw Joan Allen in, you know, that I can think of right now. She was the wife in that. That's a great movie.
I actually want to see the new Stephen King movie. It opens a Friday, and that stars Joan Allen and Vincent LaPaglia. It's called A Good Marriage. I really want to see that.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
All right, Dean,
well,
what's the next movie?
I just want to say this. I did talk to Oren Moverman, and he remembered our show because he's been a guest on the show. And I invited him on the show again, and I said, he said, get with the publicist and so forth. And I said, okay, we'll do that, when it gets closer to the release date. It doesn't have a date yet, so I said, we'd love to have Richard on. We'd like to talk to him about his entire career. And I did represent I did get a question in at the press conference, and I name checked Movie Geeks United at the press conference. So God bless you.
Let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the times that I've called people and talked to people and told them I'm from Movie Geeks United, I remember one time I called a publicist and I said, hey, this is Jamie from Movie Geeks United. And the guy was like, you must love saying that. And I was yeah. How does it feel to, like, stand up and say, Dean Treadway from Movie Geeks United?
I'm extremely proud to say it. It feels great. I feel great. I mean, that's like every house it feel to be part of the show. I feel great about the show, and I'm proud to say that I'm with Movie Geeks United, and I think it's a very memorable title. I think it's of a show. I think it's something that people glom onto and actually think is quite charming, and it says it all. So yeah, I have no qualms about saying it, and I'll scream it from the mountaintops. But I would love to talk to Richard Gere too about not only his movies but about his this is a movie that he has been kind of sitting a script that he's been sitting on for many years, like almost 20 years. So it's great that he did that too, because it wouldn't have been right for him to do it 20 years ago, but it's right now. He's at the right age to do it. It's really, I think it's a really, really excellent movie. So, I did talk to some other critics that were like, yeah, I don't know, or they were a little iffy on it. But
critics did you talk to? Anybody we would know?
I don't want to name check them, but
name check them. God damn it, we have nothing to lose.
I'm gonna. But all right,
okay.
Next movie. Next movie is the worst movie that I've seen so far at the festival, and it is called. It's actually called. It's spelled like this, J-A-U-J-A. It sounds like it's going to be Jaja, but it's actually Haha. And dumb title, dumb movie, okay? It's by a director named Lisandro Alonso. And Lisandro Alonso is actually, along with Alex Ross Perry, the director of Listen Up, Philip, is actually one of the New York Film Festival's directors in attendance, or directors in it's like they're one of their pet
residence.
Directors of the year, So, and yeah, directors in residence, filmmaker in residence. So, and this is a movie that's shot in 1:33, sort of in that same kind of framing that Meets Cut Off has. It actually kind of feels like Meets Cut Off in a lot of ways. But I would say more specifically that it's like, it's a little bit of a mix of mixed cutoff, maybe a Gear of the Wrath of God, I'm Waiting for Godot, and a Twilight Zone episode, or even worse, an M. Night Shyamalan movie. Okay? It takes place in this desolate sort of landscape. It's actually got some great locations in it. I'd say that's the best thing about it, is some of the location photography is interesting. Because it's sort of desert-like, it's sort of grassland-like, and it's sort of like beachfront-like, too. But it's like it's all of those things mixed together. It's a very, very strange place. I think they filmed it in Argentina. But it's in Danish and in Spanish, and it stars Viggo Mortensen as a commander of a small group of soldiers and workers who are fighting kind of an unseen enemy. It looks like the enemies look like they might be Indians, like Incas or Mayans or something. And for some reason, he has his daughter with him. You know, this by the way, takes place in something like the 19th or 18th century or something like that. So he has his daughter with him on this journey. And I think they're also out. Ha-Ha is, as a placard at the beginning of the movie says, is kind of a utopia that a lot of people in this time period went out searching for and disappeared trying to find. So that's where the Agira thing comes in, because, you know, they were looking for the mythical loss of City of Gold in that movie. And so... that's kind of where I get the whole Aguirre thing, plus the daughter and the commander of the army and stuff like that. So anyway, in the movie, Viggo Mortensen's daughter disappears, and Viggo Mortensen goes out into the desert to find her, and that's basically the movie. But it's one of these movies, it's about 109 minutes long, and it's one of these movies that is self-consciously, boring. it's one of these movies that has really, really, really long shots. You know, there'll be a shot of some guy walking away from the camera, and then he goes walking, 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 walking. Then he disappears, and the camera's still going, and you're like, cut already, please. And the movie is filled with lots of silences and just seems to feel like they go on forever, and it just feels so padded out. I was like sitting there going, you know, why didn't they just make this into a short film? Okay, like why did they make this into a short film? Because it could have easily been told in 30 minutes instead of this, you know, interminable length, you know. Let me just go ahead and say this is not a movie that's probably going to get any kind of distribution, okay? But I'm going to go ahead and ruin it for you, okay? This is one of the okay, I'm going to ruin it for you. I'm going to do it, all right? So if you don't want to hear this, if you're a big, big old Mortensen fan, turn away, because this is the spoiler. At the end, it's all a dream.
Oh, that's just a cop-out. That's always a cop-out. That's just a cop-out. I mean, I hate that.
Absolutely.
I mean,
it's all a dream. At the end, at the last 5 minutes of the movie, the girl in the story wakes up in a modern house, and she finds a little artifact that takes her into her dream, and she throws it in the water, and the movie is over. You know, but it's modern day. She wakes up, and it was
that's
just
lazy. That's lazy storytelling.
It's lazy storytelling.
I
did you all out there listening to the show, I did you all a favor, okay? Because, I mean, I don't know. I mean, listen, Viggo Mortensen, he's good, and it's interesting to see him speaking Danish, for instance. You know, I guess he's Danish by name, you know, by, I don't know, Mortensen's a Danish name, I'm not sure. Yeah, I mean, this is kind of a painful movie, and almost everybody agreed. I mean, like, everybody I talked to, everybody just sort of slunk out, like, oh, my God. It was like the third movie of the day, you know.
It's like, oh, when is it going to be over? So, okay. So, next movie. Things get much better from here on. I only have two more movies to report on, by the way. And I'll tell you about what I'm going to see this week. But, okay, so the two big movies here. So first, yesterday at 10 a.m., we watched Damien Chazelle's amazing, absolutely superb, stupendous movie, Whiplash.
I can't wait to see that.
It's been getting a lot of buzz for a little while now. It played at Toronto last year and then went on to Sundance, and now it's in New York, and it's about to drop nationwide. In case you don't know what it's about, Miles Teller, one of our near favorite actors, I would say. I mean, I just think he's great in everything he's in. Miles Teller plays a jazz drummer who idolizes Buddy Rich and wants to enter into this elite jazz band at the school that he's attending. And everybody wants to get into this band, but few are chosen, you know. The band is led, it's conducted by J.K. Simmons, who leads the band in a very militaristic kind of way. He doesn't suffer fools. He wants everybody to be perfect. If they're not perfect, if they're out of tune, he will browbeat them. He will browbeat them and throw them out. He has no problem throwing people out because he can always get somebody to replace you. You know, you can always be somebody to people can be replaced. So it's fine. You know, if you can't hack it, get out. And so he often goes over the line, you know, and that's really what the movie is about. The movie is about how far do teachers go to demand brilliance of people. How far is too far? Is there too far? The character, J.K. Simmons' character in it, says that the worst things that a teacher can say, two of the most harmful words in the English language, he says, is good job. He says, good job never got anybody anywhere. He said only through rigid criticism can people achieve greatness. They talk about how, Charlie Parker, when he was first starting out, this is kind of a running theme in the movie, when Charlie Parker was first starting out and first auditioning with his first band, the leader of that band got so mad at him that he threw a cymbal at his head. And Charlie Parker slunk out of there, went away for a year, practiced and practiced and practiced, and then came back and gave the greatest music the world had ever heard. And he said, what would have happened, J.K. Simmons says, what would have happened if that guy had not thrown that cymbal at Charlie Parker? Would we have had Charlie Parker? And I think that that's a very, very interesting philosophical question to ask. I mean, that's kind of a question that actually is interesting for a film critic. I mean, when I was yelled at the Atlanta Film Festival for giving bad reviews to some of the filmmakers there, I said, well, if you don't get bad reviews every once in a while, how are you going to know if you're doing good work or not? And I said, you know, look at the positive side of getting a bad review. This is a good opportunity for you to actually improve. I mean, do you want me to just say that every movie is good? Or do you want me to just give good reviews to everything? I mean, that's a road to blandness. So that's kind of where J.K. Simmons' character is as well, and that's where I can identify with this character quite a bit. But let me just say this. Denny Chazelle, this is his second movie. His first movie was called Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench. And strangely enough, I didn't know that that was his first movie because for some reason I had a copy of that movie at home that I've never watched, you know. So I'm going to go home and watch that movie. This is only his second film. He adapted this film from a 10-minute short that he had done. Chazelle is very young. He looks like a baby. In fact, Jesse Simmons was making tons of jokes about how young he is and everything, but also how brilliant he is. And truly, he is brilliant. This is an amazing movie directorial work. Every camera placement is brilliant. Every edit is amazing. I mean, there's no way that this movie is not going to get a Best Editing nomination, by the way. Which, by the way, it's going to get a Best Picture nomination. It is a crowd pleaser if there ever was one. It is ridiculously dramatic and ridiculously fun and enervating. It's like, after you watch it, it's like you just downed a pot of coffee. You know, you just feel so buzzed with it. The music is fantastic. The writing is superb. Some of the great lines of the year, I mean, are in this movie. So, I mean, the casting is brilliant. You know, on top of J.K. Simmons, there's Paul Reiser is in it. He plays Miles Teller's father. And there's just a great cast of, like, really fresh faces, too. So, an unbelievably great movie. It got such a rousing round of applause. I mean, easily the biggest applause of the few screenings that I've been to. J.K. Simmons, let me just tell you this right now, and I walked up to J.K. Simmons and told him this, too. You guys know that I have, like, sixth sense about when I see something that's going to win the Oscar. I have it, and I have been at this film festival before, twice, and I've told two people I said this to Michael Hazanavicius when The Artist played here, and I also, I walked up to Hazanavicius and I said, "You're ready to win the Oscar," and he said, "I don't think so," and I said, "I'm telling you, you're going to win it." "I'm telling you, you're going to win it." Well, we all know what happened there. And also, much earlier, I was at the 2002 or 2003 festival when Fog of War played, and I said the same thing to Errol Morris. I said, "Get ready to win the Oscar. You're going to win it this year, man." And he said, "They're never going to give me an Oscar. I just don't make those Oscar kind of movies. They don't like the way that I make documentaries. They're never going to give me one." I said, "You're going to win one, I'm telling you." And he won. So I walked up to J.K. Simmons and I said, "Okay, I don't want to jinx it or anything like that, but I'm telling you, you're going to win the Oscar this year for supporting actor." And he said, "Oh, from your mouth to God's ears," or whatever. And I said, "Yeah, you believe it. I have a thing about this. I have a little bell that goes off in my head when I see it. You know, when I see the one, and you're the one. I'm telling you,
you are the chosen one."
Huh?
Well, his have been the he has been the source of all of the Oscar buzz for Whiplash. So everybody said that he's definitely going to be nominated. I think he could win if they nominate Steve Carell for Best Actor.
Yes, that will be I think Foxcatcher will probably be the. You know, or maybe somebody in Birdman, I guess, maybe. Maybe Inherent Vice, I'm not sure. But I just feel like the J.K. Simmons, you see, this movie, I don't want to make this sound like it's the most ridiculously original movie of all time, because you can reduce it down to say something like, it's kind of like if Officer and a Gentleman met the 1980 movie Fame, and they got together and had a baby. That's kind of like what this is. So, but that said, that just lets you know what kind of very big crowd-pleasing movie this is. And we all know that Louis Gossett Jr. won an Oscar for his performance in Officer and a Gentleman, and I would say that that's kind of a corollary to this performance, J.K. Simmons' performance. He has such power. It looks like he buffed up for it. He lost a little weight. He's every movement that he makes has purpose and meaning and direction. It's just the kind of performance that wins. He's at that right age too, because they like to give the best supporting actor to men in this kind of age range that he's in. It's almost a lead performance masquerading as a supporting actor performance. So that's another thing too. So he's got a lot of quote unquote Oscar-y moments, and I say that in the best way possible. You know, some people might go, you know, but no, it's really amazing. It's impossible not to like this movie.
Okay.
So last
movie.
I would say that's an unqualified rave, you know. And it looks like, you know, I've talked to the publicist for that film as well, and it looks like, you know, we might be talking to those guys as well. So look out for that. Apparently, I think the junket is sometime like maybe a week or two off. So, but we'll hopefully get them on the show, because it's just magnificent. You know, just lots of fun, but also just ridiculously dramatic. So.
So what's the last
now you get a little bit of rap in the background. So. there we go. A little bit of New York ambiance there for you. Okay. So you're ready for the next movie, right?
Last movie, yes.
All right. Last night, went to go see, or was it last night? No, it was the night before last. Friday night, stood in line for 3 hours or so to go and see the premiere of Gone Girl, the new David Fincher movie. And let me tell you, okay, so hopefully we all know what Gone Girl is about, but just in case we don't, I'll just, you know, just try and keep it short and say that Ben Affleck is in it, and he plays a man that's married to a woman played by Rosamund Pike, and they start off with kind of a perfect marriage, and then one day he comes home and discovers that his wife has disappeared, and there's the house is in a little bit of a disarray, and then it's basically, you know, then the police show up and the investigation begins, and that's what the movie is. The movie is, you know, and I'm struggling not to give anything away, because I tried to stay away from learning anything about the movie so I could be surprised. I know that it's based on a very very popular novel by Gillian Flynn, and I really didn't want to know anything about it. So I'm going to try and stay away from talking about what happens in it, okay? But
everyone else has too. Every review, I mean, I've never read so many reviews where the critics say the publicist, the studio told us not to talk about Rosamund Pike. I've never read so many reviews that where publicists and studio executives figured into the review.
Ah, interesting.
No,
well,
no, because you can't. You can't talk about the movie really at all. You really can't talk about the movie in
it. It also goes to show how much they like it.
Yeah.
If they're respecting it,
the Variety review didn't even mention Neil Patrick Harris in it. But let's just talk about some of the people that are in it, okay?
Yeah,
so we get
an
idea of, you know, who's in it. So Neil Patrick Harris is in it. Is you know, an old lover of Rosamund Pike. Let's just say that. Tyler Perry, who's amazing in it, I thought. I mean, just, I was blown away by how good he is. Like, very understated good, too. Like, not an Oscar-y kind of performance, but a very real performance, you know? Like, I mean, and I do like him. I mean, I like him as Medea. I wish the movies were a little bit better, but I think he's good as that character. So, but here he plays a kind of Johnny Cochran-like lawyer that comes in to help Ben Affleck. Interestingly enough, there's David Clinton is in it, and I forget the woman's name that plays the mother, but he's the father, Rosamund Pike's father and mother. I won't tell you anything about, you know, the backstory of their characters, but I love David Clinton. David Clinton has been in tons of movies. He's been all over the place, I mean, like, for years. And he's aged greatly, by the way. I mean, like, it was kind of shocking to see how he's aged, you know. He's got a really unusual face now because it's just, I don't know. It was shocking to see how wrinkled he's become, so to say. But at any rate, if you don't know who David Clinton is, you know, he's been in, you know, Being There, he played a lawyer in Being There, and he's just been in tons of movies. It was just, I feel like I haven't seen him in forever. He also played the head of the ad agency that the TV series 30 something. He was great on that show. I think he won an Emmy for that. Also another amazing performance by an actress that I really wasn't familiar with named Kim Dickens, who plays plays the lead investigator, the lead Missouri investigator, because a lot of this action happens in Missouri. She plays the lead investigator. And let's just say that this movie is about, basically, the duplicitous nature of being in a marriage. It's about, let's just say that it's of a piece of David Fincher's other movies that deal with people with serious problems with their brain wiring. Even the very first shot, is of the top of Rosamund Pike's head, you know, as she's laying in bed. You just see her blonde hair. And Ben Affleck comes on over the narration, and he says, "When I look at my wife's head, I'd like to split it open just to see how things work in there." You know, and I thought that's great. It reminds me of the head in the box in Seven, for one thing, and it also reminds me of that line in Seven where Morgan Freeman tells the rest of the FBI. He says if John Doe's head splits open and a UFO flies out, I want you to have expected it. I love that line. So it is a movie that has grown in my estimation since I walked out of it. There was something about it when I first took it in that it felt like a really, really, really well produced and well made all around episode of a crime show or something, or a Lifetime movie or something, like the best Lifetime movie that could ever be made. But I think that now that I've thought about it for a little while and ruminated on it, I think that that's doing it a disservice to say.
Oh, it's doing it a tremendous.
David Fincher directs the greatest Lifetime movie ever made.
I want to say this. By saying that, I want to say this because I don't think too much of Gillian Flynn, but I am impressed that she wrote the screenplay, and so I'm curious to see what she left in and what she left out. But to say that, just remember what Coppola said about The Godfather. They want me to direct this Harold Robbins crap. Yeah. I mean, I always thought that was one of the funniest lines. And that's what I kind of think with Gillian Flynn, too. I mean, David Fincher was, like, probably going, yeah, has the same kind of reaction, but he was able. But here's the thing with Fincher, though. He can work wonders with it like Coppola. He can. I mean, if Coppola did The Carpetbaggers, we'd be talking about The Carpetbaggers still today. You know, so.
Well, David Fincher is an exceptional director, but, you know.
Yeah, no, David Fincher is the exceptional director.
It is curious to me that his last two movies have been based on these really popular, you know, potboilers that people pick up and read in airports. It just seems like he's mining material that seems too mainstream and commercial for his instincts. But maybe I don't know his instincts.
But doesn't that go to his back to his whole career, though? I mean, David Fincher has the greatest career of any director in the modern era. He never had to struggle to make a movie. He never had to really. He was in the studio system almost immediately from after graduation from high school. He was in the studio system, made music videos. He knew he came from a nourishing household that said, "Yes, I want to. We want you to do this if you want to do it." And he gets in there. He never had to go. He never had to beg anyone to make a movie. He was like, "All right, you know, they want me to do Alien 3. Okay, let's do Alien 3."
Well, I mean,
you know,
you're right about that. You're right about that in the respect that in the regard that he never had to beg to get on a movie set as director.
Right.
But he had to struggle to present his vision. On Alien 3 and on 7. People didn't want to make the movie that he wanted to make, and he had to essentially trick the studio into believing that he was making the movie they wanted to make.
Okay, but let me give you a corollary. I agree with everything you said, but he was in. He was in. It didn't matter. Fuck everything else. When you get in, Jamie, that doesn't matter. When you're in that part of the struggle, you are in. That's all that counts. It doesn't.
Yeah.
When you were outside, when you're the guy inside, you know, outside in the fogged out windows and everyone's having a good time, yeah, of course there's a struggle inside. But when you have the struggle inside, you're doing all right. You're doing okay.
Well,
when you can get that meeting.
And to his credit,
I agree.
To his credit, how many directors get in and then they just fold because they don't want to be thrown out again?
Yeah, but he got in, though. That's the whole thing. He got in with his rebellious vision, and here we are, 30 years later, he's still there. That's the incredible thing. But, I mean, we don't even get, the three of us don't even get the opportunity to even get to that part of the struggle. We're still, do you want me to take the negatives over? Okay. You know, so.
Please, let's not go over the negatives. But, let me just say this. I just have to put an addendum, you know, that I was leading up to. I have thought about the movie, and I think it's a really great movie. I mean, it's absolutely impeccable, really. And it has stayed with me, and it has made me. It's haunting. It really is. It's quite haunting, and. Gosh, I have a line about it that I would love to say, but it would give something away, so I'm not going to say the line. But
Dean, you've given too much away as it is.
I'm not gonna talk about the plot. So, if you're a movie lover, you have to go see it. I mean, it's imperative. You know, it's a must. It'll be out, I guess, later on this week. I don't know if it's dropping all across the nation, but I guess
it's a nationwide. It's a nationwide October 3rd.
Okay.
Yeah.
But Affleck was there, and Tyler Perry was there, Rosamund Pike, Neil Patrick Harris, Gillian Flynn, and also, of course, Henry Fincher. And, you know, everybody on the stage, as you can well imagine, were very deferential. They said, you know, like Affleck said, I shut down a movie that I was working on to come and work to direct and to come and do this with Fincher because he wanted to learn from Fincher. He said he talked about Seven as being the most perfect Swiss watch of a movie, and he had to see how this director
worked. And Tyler Perry basically said the almost, you know, very similar things. He said, "Yeah, I just had to come and learn from this director, you know." And Tyler Perry was actually very self-deferential in a lot of ways, because he said, you know, I often wish that my own movies had more of a directorial thrust than they have, and so I felt like he could get something very unusual out of this role.
Don't you feel like Tyler Perry is backtracking a little bit from his revelation last month that he never knew who David Fincher was before he agreed to work on the movie? Is he making up for that?
I didn't know that he had said that.
Oh, did he?
I don't know. I had no idea who David Fincher was
before I agreed to do the movie. And if I had known, I wouldn't have done the movie. That's what he said in an interview.
Wow.
What an idiot. Huh.
Well, by the way, Tyler Perry was surrounded by bodyguards, big old bodyguards. I said, Tyler Perry needs bodyguards? I mean, you know, everybody else, no bodyguards, you know, even Ben Affleck, you know. Lots of a great press conference, by the way. Lots of very funny comments about Ben Affleck as Batman. One of the people who asked the question referred to him as Bruce Wayne. that got a big laugh from the audience. And he was actually quite amazingly funny and sharp up there. Rosamund Pike, of course, is British, and she actually exudes kind of a almost a Hitchcockian feel, like a Kim Novak type feel. And Fincher, you know, Fincher said something really interesting about Rosamund Pike, and which I could relate to very much. I personally really have no recollection of ever seeing Rosamund Pike in anything, even though she's probably been in a lot of movies that I've seen. But I really don't have any kind of vision of who she is, really, until this movie. And David Fincher actually said the same thing. He said, Rosamund Pike has been in a lot of movies, but for some reason I haven't been able to put my finger on who she is, really. And so that's why I wanted to cast her, because she had, as he put it, a sort of opacity to her that was perfect for this character. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you, she is amazing in the film. She is just chameleon-like in it. She's so superb in it. Also, interestingly enough, I should mention also that Patrick Pugin is in it as well. He was, you know, people might remember him as being the kid in Almost Famous. He plays the sort of the cop that's in there with Kim Dickens, sort of her second in command or whatever. He's very amusing in it. And also, this is a little personal story too. by the way, I've interviewed Patrick Fugit. I interviewed him for Almost Famous. I'm just mentioning these things in my past here. There's an actor in it named Boyd Holbrook. Now, Boyd Holbrook is one of the most unbelievably handsome guys around, okay? I mean, like just ridiculous movie star handsome, but he's always in these supporting roles. But let's do this. I mean, I'm just going to mention four movies that this guy has done, okay? He was one of the big supporters of Harvey Milk in Gus Van Sant's Milk. He was one of Liberace's lovers, you know, post Matt Damon lovers in Steven Soderbergh's Behind the Candelabra. He's also in a yet unreleased Terrence Malick movie. I think he's in Nine of Cups or one of those movies. And then here he is. He pops up in this. Now, why do I mention Boyd Holbrook? Boyd Holbrook, I'm staying in Bushwick on Star Street. This is a street that I used to live on when I lived in Bushwick many years ago, even before I even called into the show for the first time. And Boyd Holbrook was my upstairs neighbor. Boyd Holbrook actually, to tell you the truth, Boyd Holbrook saved my life once. As I said, he was the upstairs neighbor. I would go to parties that he'd put on and stuff like that. He was very, very charming, very great guy. Gave me a lot of great advice about movies and so forth. A particular script that I have boiling in my head, you know, he gave me some great advice about that and I still remember to this day. But one day I had had a little bit too much to drink and I had fallen asleep. And I fell asleep with something on the stove that was burning. And the place was filled up with smoke. And so I'm asleep, and then I hear bam, bam, bam. And then the door flies up, my front door flies open. And there's Boyd, and he's saying, man, what's going on down here? And places, I wake up, the place is filled with smoke, and I was totally disoriented, and I said, oh, my God, I fell asleep. I just passed out with this thing on just completely embarrassed and also completely thankful and everything. I mean, who knows what could have happened. But anyway, I was so incredibly thankful. But as always, I was poor at that time. So I what can I do for this guy? I don't have any money. I need to give him some kind of gift because this is, ridiculous. I wish I could take him out to dinner or something like that. So I just gave him one of my favorite books, which is a Charles M. Schulz Peanuts book. And I said, you know, I don't know how to thank you for this, but I'm all I can do is give you something that's very important to me. Anyway, he pops up in the movie, and every time Boyd pops up in a movie, I go, is that Boyd? Oh, my God, he's in this? This is crazy. I won't tell you who he plays in it, but let's just say he plays somebody that does something bad to Rosamund Pike. Let's just say that. Just amazing. Now, my last story about this is... So I'm sitting in the movie, and the movie's over, and the press conference is over, and everybody's filing up, and I just happen to be on the aisle. So I get out right at the moment where Neil Patrick Harris is in front of me, and I tapped him on the shoulder, and I said, Neil, hey, I'm Dean Treadway. I'm with Movie Geeks United podcast. Told me a little bit about the podcast. So I said, I'm not sure if you remember this, but I interviewed you once back in 1987 or 88. I was in college, and you were down in Atlanta, and I interviewed you. He said, what was it for? Was it for this thing? And I said, no, it was for Clara's Heart, that movie you did with Whoopi Goldberg. And he said, oh, my God, oh, jeez. And I said, I don't know if you were, your dad was with you. And we were at a California pizza kitchen. He went, oh, my God, in the mall? In that mall? And I said, yeah, in the second floor of the mall. Yeah, absolutely. Do you remember that? He said, oh, yeah, of course. And he said, it's great to see you. And I said, I just want to tell you, I really find your career, like, amazingly inspirational. You know, I just think you've gone, you continually surprise me. With everything that you do on stage and in movies and this movie too. And I just wanted to say that and say hello to you. And so that was it. That was all.
You know
I
what?
Said.
You know what? I have interviewed one person in the Gone Girl movie. Jerry, do you know
one person? What?
From the Gone Girl movie. Jerry, do you know who we've had on the show that's in Gone Girl?
Haven't we had Rosamund Pike on the show for this?
That's
for
right.
For Barney's version, right?
Yeah, and when I interviewed her, I ended up talking to her about my girlfriend problems.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
Wow.
Yeah, it was good.
Wow.
It was good.
What kind of advice? Did she give you some kind of advice, or how did that come up?
No, honestly, and it's so ironic because it ties into her character in Gone Girl, because we're talking about having a long-term relationship and never really fully knowing the person that you're with. And so we had that conversation, and so that's so ironic that Gone Girl is about that very thing. Yeah.
That is how all I could think of was Barney's version in that interview while watching, because she's also in Hector in The Search for Happiness. She plays Simon Pegg's girlfriend, and I was watching that, and I was like thinking of Barney's version the whole time, and Paul Giamatti.
I've even watched Barney's version, and I just don't remember her in it. I'm sure she's great in it and everything, but there's just something about that actress. Maybe she's just totally disappearing in these things, and so much so that it's difficult.
Remember, she's in The World's End. I'm sure you remember that.
Oh, God.
I remember her in, the big movie that she's been in the past year or two is Jack Reacher.
Yeah, Jack Reacher, but also Die Another Day. Die Another Day she's in.
Oh, wow. Well, she's the front runner for the actress Oscar. I mean, you know, I could easily see that going to her, and probably a Best Picture nomination for it. And I say that I want to also underline the fact that this is a movie that is just as beautiful to look at as any of David Fincher's other movies. It's got the Jeff Cronenworth photography. It's got the Kirk Baxter editing. It's got the great, unbelievably great score from Reznor and Ross. A score that's almost on par with Social Network. And I can easily
Guys, they obviously are going for Oscar here. The release date is exactly the same release time frame as The Social Network. They're all, this is really going, they are really gunning for The Social Network. Everything here is coming. And it's really funny you bring up The Social Network because this is one of the, even though Rooney Mara had been in other things before The Social Network, it's her first big part it's all coming together here. They're really going for The Social Network, everything that works so well. But they're just hoping that, you are going to have another movie that is going to sweep it. You're going to have two movies, maybe. The one about Stephen Hawking, and then the Imitation Game, I think, is going to be its main competition. Unless, also Inherent Vice and maybe Unbroken.
Yeah, Inherent Vice, Birdman,
We haven't even gotten with Birdman yet. Yeah, and Wild.
And Foxcatcher, too. So,
yeah,
the one thing about Inherent Vice and Birdman is that those movies might be so unusual that it might be a kind of thing where, I don't know, they'll probably get Best Picture nominations, probably don't have any chance of winning.
Let me ask you guys this, because when I did Jason's show the other week, he was doing the insanely early Oscar predictions, and both of them, both he and Garney, were adamant in thinking that Unbroken was going to win Best Picture, and I was the only one that said, but what if that doubted that thought. It just looks too Hallmarky. What if it's not
too baby, too Oscar baby? Like
there is
a point
Oscar baby
overboard.
They thought the same thing with Seabiscuit by the same author.
I know.
So
exactly.
But it's not. Now here's the thing. I'm sure it could be a very good movie, but it's so. It's just so. As you say, Oscar baity. I think let's not rule out Paul Thomas Anderson. But let's not rule out David Fincher. Let's not also rule out Christopher Nolan for Interstellar. If that is good, the Oscar voters may gravitate towards that.
And I just want to reiterate, too, that Boyhood is way in the conversation, even though
Boyhood has to be. If Boyhood is not, if Boyhood does not get a nomination for director, or does not
director,
get major nomination,
picture,
and
director,
actor,
picture, supporting actress, screenplay, editing. It's, I mean, it's got to get those five. I mean, I think
you know
I
what?
Think,
I'm just telling you. I'm just telling you.
Will be in there. Yeah.
I'm telling you that Unbroken. This is my prediction. This early, Unbroken will not win Best Picture. Unbroken will be nominated. I won't be surprised if it's nominated. I won't even be, you know, I'm not even totally 100% convinced that Angelina won't be nominated for Best Director if it turns out to be a good movie. And this could actually be a historic year where two females are nominated for Best Director because the director of Selma is also a woman and a first time, I think.
DuVernay, yeah. So, yeah, absolutely. And Selma is another one that's probably I can easily see Selma more than Unbroken getting in the race.
And I want to say,
you know, let's just say this. Inevitably, in every year, there's a movie that comes out that people are saying, oh, this is definitely going to be in. I mean, no question about it. This is going to be in. There's always that one movie that says, oh, it's really not that good.
No, it is. You're absolutely right. A possibility that Unbroken could be that movie. But I would not rule out I'll be honest. Rosamund Pike is definitely a front runner for Best Actress. I think Reese Witherspoon will be also the other front runner for Wild.
Yeah.
And maybe a supporting actress for Inherent Vice. I mean, let's not
You're
rule out Inherent
Catherine,
Vice.
Catherine Masterson. Catherine Masterson for Inherent Vice is what they're talking about.
Yeah. There could be a lot going on.
Always, it's crunch time, and we're going to get 100 movies in the next two months, you know, and they're going to be impossible to see them all and everything. So, I mean, yeah, of course, it's going to be chaos. I'll tell you the most.
So, Dean, you're seeing. Hang on. We got to close this out soon. So, Dean, you're seeing Inherent Vice next week, right?
Next Saturday, yes. I will be in the audience, the first audience to see Inherent Vice at 10 a.m. at the Walter Reed Cinema. My plan is that everybody in the movie is going to be there. Reese Witherspoon and Joaquin Phoenix and of course Paul Thomas Anderson and then Benicio del Toro and Martin Short and Maya Rudolph and Catherine Masterson and just everybody is going to be there. So it is going to be a ridiculous event. So much so that I'm probably going to have to get there, 3 hours in advance just to stand in line with the rest of the press. So I'm planning to get up at like 5 a.m. that day to go down to Walter Reed to sit around and drink coffee and try stay awake or whatever. I'm just going to have to go to bed at at an unusually early time for me, like something like 9 o'clock or something. That's next. That's the big thing. I have a very, very busy week. I would say that, one of the things I'm going to see tomorrow is the new Martin Scorsese documentary, The 50-Year Argument. It's about the New York Review of Books. Also, of course, the big thing for me is on Friday, I'll be seeing Mr. Turner, the new Mike Lee movie, and Mike Lee's going to be there. But let me just tell you guys, too, that Kennedy Spall's going to be there. And I brought up I bought a Life is Sweet poster to get them to sign it, so I hope I get to sign it and get them to sign it and have a few moments with my favorite film director in the world. Again, the second time meeting him. I hope that happens. And also, I did bring up an original Magnolia poster. I said to myself, if I get a chance to have Paul Thomas Anderson in front of me and I don't have this poster with me, I'd just be kicking myself. So I'm going to take it up there. I'd take it up there anyway and just try it and see, So interesting, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But lots of documentaries this week. I'll report all on them all, you know, next week. We'll be coming. I'll be sitting right here outside of the Councilman Astoria Studios here next week as well. And we'll I'm thinking that we should, you know, record the show on Saturday just to get the first review up and the on the internet of it, you know. So but at any rate, you know, we'll soon know. I mean, I'm pretty sure it's going to be great, but you know, just what kind
well, maybe
of
it won't be.
maybe
this time next week, Dean will be getting hate mail for not liking Inherent Vice. Who knows?
Yeah.
It's possible.
So, hey, let me tell you, Jerry, I told this to Dean, but I didn't tell you. So I went to go see Gone Girl yesterday morning,
mm-hmm.
So and it was screening at 11 a.m. So I drove to Tampa, which is 45 minutes away. I got
got out of my car.
I couldn't find my wallet. So I'm like, well, I can't sit through that movie. If I've lost my wallet, I'll just be thinking about my lost wallet the whole time I'm sitting at the movie. So then I drove all the way back. I drove all the way back home, and went to the only place that I stopped at, which was a gas station that morning, and it wasn't anywhere. Nobody turned it in. So I've lost all identification. I have to prove to people who I am. So it's like the most.
Oh man, I'm sorry.
Worst feeling. It's
oh, it is.
So
yeah, I hate that. I've had to do that. It's horrible.
Every bank
losing your phone. You know, losing your phone or losing your wallet or phone these days is a big deal. So I mean, but yeah, I mean that's a bad.
So yesterday morning was supposed to be Gone Girl morning, and instead it was Gone Wallet morning. So, I mean, and which made me think, how stupid is it that we keep every single identification we have in one little square leather pouch?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how delicate
is
that?
It is absurd.
It is absurd. But it's even more absurd with a phone now. I mean, with a smartphone, I mean, it's even more absurd.
Yeah, you keep your whole life in that, too, you know? It's just like,
okay.
I'm sorry that happened. But hey, so
I'm very sorry.
October 1st is the first episode of Pencil Down Tragedies, right?
Yes, that's Wednesday, and the first episode is Peg Entwistle. So that's up and ready to go. So everyone out there who's seen this episode one on their iTunes feed for the past 3 weeks, and they haven't been able to play it. That's why it's there to tease you. You'll be able to play it on October 1st at 10 o'clock Eastern time at night. You'll be able to play it, and then the second episode is in post right now, and the second episode is turning out really promisingly, where we're actually helping the cold case detectives actually try to solve this thing.
This is just so fascinating. I can't wait to hear
this.
I cannot wait to hear the show.
You know, as we were just to tell the listeners, Jamie and I were talking about this episode about Krista Helm and how ridiculously complicated it is and colorful, and also how Jamie, how you're kind of connecting dots that have never been connected before, and in this very, very cold case. So I just, you know, I my hat's off to you for all the work you're doing on all of these episodes and just the whole idea of doing it. And I love the idea, too, that it's happening in October, you know, the month of Halloween. It's just a little bit of sort of creepiness, Hollywood creepiness for Halloween. And I guess we're going to do that next year and in coming years, too. So
you know,
I
was
think that's
telling
a great idea, too.
Jerry. Here's my idea for one of the episodes next year for Tinseltown Tragedies. I was telling this to Dean. Tony Scott. I mean, who the hell knows what happened to Tony Scott? That story
I would
was
love
just
to.
Not.
I would really love to do that. I would really love to do that. That'd be great.
I like your idea about covering the Manson, the effect that the Manson killings had on Hollywood. Not not covering actually the killings, not covering the murders, because that's been covered to death, but how Hollywood reacted to it, how the doors got battened down, you know. So I think that's a very, very interesting subject.
It'll be good. I can tell you guys
that for a movie, you know.
This Krista Helm episode will be the sexiest episode we've ever done on Movie Geeks United.
Wow. Yes, you're right. It will be.
As if the three of us didn't provide enough sexy for the past 7 years.
Yeah,
I know, really.
I think we bring a lot of sex appeal to the internet with our weekly our weekly ranting and ratings.
Yeah. I'm sure. By the way, a lot of people out there randy. Okay. All right.
I'm easily the least sexy person on the face of the earth. So just like.
On that note, we will come back to you guys next week. Dean will have the first review of Inherent Vice for you guys. It'll be an exciting time. Jerry, you got anything going on?
Yes. I'm just looking forward to watch Gone Girl next weekend. So.
Yeah. Everybody's going to be out there. So. And you're going to have a great time, I'm telling you. And it's going to make a lot of people angry, you know. After it's out for a little while and they think that people have seen it or whatever, because everybody's going to rush out and go see it in the first 2 weeks anyway, maybe we can talk a little bit more about the controversial aspects of the movie.
Right.
Because I definitely think we need to discuss the movie at length again later on in the year.
No, and I think we'll have to discuss that. I think Fincher has found a soulmate in Gillian Flynn because they're going to make a TV series together called Utopia based on a British series. So he's returning to television, and he's done incredible stuff for television so far. And I think he's also doing something with James Ellroy, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he's doing something for HBO with James Ellroy.
So,
okay,
I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on.
Well, I'm all about relationships being a crock of shit, so I'm looking forward to Gone Girl. So that's right.
Maybe you and I, if I could fly down, if I could come down to Florida, I'd go see it with you, Jamie.
Gone
Girl, for me, Gone Girl is going to be like a motivational speech. It's I'm going to read it differently.
That is so true. After when it was all over, I said, Jesus Christ, I've never been more glad in my life that I'm not married and I'm a lonely fuck. Seriously, I'd much rather be by myself than dealing with that kind of shit. But anyway.
Okay,
all
so
right,
guys, thank you. I'll see you all next week. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, great, man.
And,
thank you.
Keep watching movies, everybody. See you later.
All right, see you. Good night, everyone.
Bye.